I used to just go with whatever meat looked good or was on sale at the grocery store. But now that I've experienced the exceptional quality, flavor, and convenience that you can get from Omaha Steaks, I'm never going back. They can build a custom food plan based on your schedule, which means less food waste and stocking up on high-quality proteins to always have on hand. With Omaha Steaks in your freezer, you're always just minutes away from a quality dinner, whether it's Taco Tuesday or a weekend feast. Taste the Omaha Steaks difference and never settle for grocery proteins again. Get flavorful, high-quality proteins delivered by visiting omahasteaks.com, plus $35 off when you use promo code YUM at checkout. That's omahasteaks.com, code YUM. Terms apply. See site for details. Go to omahasteaks.com and use promo code YUM at checkout for $35 off. Minimum purchase may apply.
Many of you have been following my holistic health journey with Holistic Goddess and their amazing products. I can't tell you how much it eases my mind to have a brand I can truly rely on. Everything is crafted with care and aligns perfectly with my wellness values. I have to share my latest obsession, castor oil by Queen of the Thrones. I've been learning so much about clean and natural health and the importance of using quality products. This one is a total game changer. What I love about Queen of Thrones castor oil is that it's 100% pure, hexane-free, and extra virgin, all packed in a glass bottle. It's thoroughly sourced and third-party tested, so I know I can trust what I'm putting on my body. The organic golden castor oil is incredibly versatile. I use it to regenerate my skin for a firmer look and reduce the appearance of fine lines, wrinkles, and crow's feet. It also supports my hair's appearance, helping hair look stronger and adds shine while being deeply hydrating for my scalp. Plus, it works wonders as a natural makeup remover and moisturizer. It truly covers all bases. It even pairs beautifully with the original castor oil pack for full body wellness. If you're looking to elevate your wellness routine like I have, I highly recommend checking out Queen of Thrones Organic Golden Castor Oil on the Holistic Goddess website. It's been a fantastic addition to my self-care, and it might just be what you need too. For more info, visit holisticgoddess.com and discover how castor oil can support your wellness journey today. Use my code UNDERSTOOD for a special discount of 15% off. Welcome back to Misunderstood. I'm your host, Rachel Yucatel. I'm really excited for you guys to listen to today's episode. Today, we're sitting down with Kate Taylor. She is the senior features correspondent for Business Insider. Kate's known for her in-depth investigative work covering everything from business trends to major industry scandals. We'll be talking about her journey, how she found her way into journalism, what inspired her to become a writer, and what drives her passion for uncovering the stories that matter. We also dig into two of her biggest stories that made a huge impact. One, exposing the scandal at Nickelodeon, which you may or may not have seen stuff about, maybe it was last year. And another one, uncovering some shocking details about the fashion brand Brandy Melville. These investigations were so powerful that they didn't just stay on the page. They turned into full-length documentaries. You guys really need to check them out. We're excited to hear from Kate about her career, her approach to storytelling, and what it's like to break stories that can shake up entire industries. We also hear what she's going to be following and covering next. Please enjoy my conversation with the one and only Kate Taylor. Hey, Kate, thank you so much for joining me on Misunderstood. How are you?
Yes, thank you for having me. I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm great. I feel like it's such an honor to meet you. You are such a well-respected journalist. And in this day and age, I feel like it's very hard to find actual people that do this for a living because so many people have become journalists in social media. They're covering things like they have all the inside scoop when they're getting it from people like you. So I wanted to say thank you. And I wanted to have you on to really talk about the details of how you kind of investigate stories, get them into print, and then how that translates on screen for us all to enjoy. So I think you're fascinating. So again, thank you.
Yes, of course. And I love talking about kind of the process and helping illuminate how it all comes together.
Yeah. So actually, my first question is, I know you're at Columbia University right now, taking time out to do this fellowship. Can you tell us what you're doing there?
Yes, I'm doing the Knight Badge fellowship right now at Columbia, which is a fellowship for business journalists, where we basically go to Columbia Business School for a year. And it's an opportunity to kind of learn all of the wonky details about accounting and statistics and economics. And I've been reporting kind of on businesses, but mostly for a non-businessy audience for the last 10 years. So it was a chance to really go deeper and learn those hard skills, but also to meet a bunch of different people and kind of learn about how all of these people see business and see the world. So it's been a really interesting time, and I've been really loving the chance to kind of go deep on these hard skills that I did not learn in college, because I wanted to be a writer and I never thought about being a business writer until it kind of ended up happening that way.
Yeah, business writing is such a different thing. So I worked at Bloomberg News for many years. And what I found is there were two different ways to go about like having that job. You had to learn television and news, but then you also, you know, the facets of what goes into breaking news and what goes into a story and the facts and being first and all that stuff. And then business is totally different. You have to, you know, there has to be stuff about the company and the scandal that goes involved, or like hitting their numbers, or, you know, it's just such a different ball game. So it is difficult. And I don't think people realize that, but people that are consuming entertainment news, you know, it's just the dirty details that they care about, I think. So how did you get into wanting to be a writer when you were younger?
I was someone who I always loved writing. I loved reading so much. I think pretty much my entire career can be based on the fact that I just love to read. And in college, I majored in history. I was someone who loved that because I could read, I could write, I could read all these archival sources. But when I was graduating, I wasn't sure what I wanted to do with that degree necessarily. So yeah, I wanted a job where I could write every day, which ended up being an intern at Forbes magazine. So that I really ended up loving that. But I wasn't someone in college who was super involved in the school newspaper. I wrote an advice column. I wasn't someone who was doing these deep dive investigations, who knew that that was going to be what I wanted to do with my life. It was more the writing and love of writing and research came first, and then reporting kind of followed that.
So you're known as now the senior features correspondent at Business Insider. Can you talk about how you got that job?
Yeah. So after college, I was at Forbes as an intern for a bit. Then I went from there to Entrepreneur Magazine, where I ended up reporting on franchises. So that's a lot of reporting on fast food, but other franchises and franchises in general. And then Business Insider around 2015 reached out to me and said, hey, like, we want someone to write about the business of fast food. And I had some background doing that. And I loved writing about fast food as a business, because I think that that's something that everyone can relate to and everyone's interested in. I think you understand, having worked at Bloomberg, that all of these companies, there's so much inherent drama and interesting stories there. But I think that for a lot of readers, it doesn't feel super immediate to them, or it doesn't feel relevant to them. And fast food, it's one of those business stories that does feel relevant to everyone, because people can be like, okay, I don't care that much about the CEO, or like, what does inflation mean to me? But then when you say, oh, this is going to increase the price of your hamburger by this much, that impacts everyone across the country.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I think in fast food, people started paying attention, or at least I started paying attention a lot more when that guy, now I'm going to forget his name, he's dead now from cancer, but Morgan Spurlock.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
The fast food.
Yes.
And what was that called? Fast Food Nation.
Supersize Me.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And that was a crazy inside look into what fast food does for you. I mean, that's one specific angle. But, I found it fascinating. And then I think people are kind of wondering, did he die early because of, you know, his exposure to fast food? Were you doing the covering of that stuff when that movie came out?
I was a little bit after the movie, but I think that the impact of that movie was so great on the industry, where for so long, I think these companies were like, okay, all customers want is like, how much bang can they get for their buck? Can they get more, more, more for less money? And then that movie came out and people were like, actually, this is really bad for us. Like, maximizing how many calories we can get for the least amount of dollars is actually harmful. And like, that is not a good deal. That is a bad deal for us in an entirely different way. So when I started reporting on fast food, it was a bit more of like, okay, how do we win customers over while not just making it really, really cheap to consume a ton of calories. And I think that they're still trying to figure that out. It's interesting. I mean, in the pandemic, all of these places just stopped serving salads. And I think that they still haven't brought back the salads at a lot of places, because it was everyone added salads to the menu in part to be like, oh no, we can be a healthy choice. But yeah. it's this interesting balance where these type of companies, they have customers who say they want to be healthy, but in reality, do they actually want to be healthy? And I think that it's a difficult business decision to distinguish what people say they want versus what they really want.
Do you think they're, I'm just curious, do you think they're really catering to people that don't, you know, that cannot afford going out to regular, you know, to supermarkets and spending that kind of money and, you know, going out to eat? I mean, are we talking about a much more low economic group of people, or that, you know, is fast food catering to everyone and just trying to make it edible? And they're, that's why they're putting so much sugar in, because you get addicted to it. I mean, there's so many different things that
people, I know there's so much there. It's fascinating. And it's a little bit different for different chains. I think that they ultimately are trying to cater to everyone. And like, yeah, that is always the goal, because if you have a customer who is only going there because it's the only thing they can afford, then if you raise prices a little bit, then you lose them and then you don't have anyone shopping there. So I think all of them are trying to maximize, but it is sometimes, I mean, when the economy is tough, you have more people going to McDonald's for a little bit of time. Like it's all this kind of like interesting series of checks and balances there, where it's a fascinating business to write about. And I really enjoyed writing about it. And then I kind of went from that to doing more long form features. And then that turned into doing more investigations as well. And I mean, one of the first big long form things I did was about McDonald's CEO, who was basically ousted in this sex scandal, where it was all of this wild kind of behind the scenes stuff that you expect for a company that's a little bit more hip than McDonald's, but it's happening. It was such a wild story. And I was like, what is actually going on here? So that was one that one of my first bigger features.
So had the news come out that he was already ousted, and then you were like, let me go down this rabbit hole and see what happened?
Yes. And that was kind of, he was ousted very suddenly. Mm-hmm. And then months later, he was ousted for kind of inappropriate relationships with one woman. And then months later, it came out that there had been other women at McDonald's that he had been having, kind of exchanging sexual messages and photos with. Mm-hmm. And one of the women apparently had received kind of preferential treatment as a result. So it was, I kind of just talked to everyone I could. I think that there were still, I would love to revisit that story because I still have questions about what exactly happened. But among the people I talked to his former girlfriend, the CEO's former girlfriend, to be like, what happened here? Like, what was this guy like? And just something I always enjoy in reporting is trying to understand the human motivations behind these decisions, especially when they're inexplicable or bad decisions. So just being like, why would someone who has his dream job blow it up in this manner?
You know, running a business can be challenging, especially when it comes to managing sales and making sure everything runs smoothly. That's where Shopify has made all the difference for me. For our misunderstood merch, Shopify has been a game changer. Before, we struggled with keeping track of orders and making the buying business seamless for our fans. But now everything's in one place. The checkout process, super smooth, just like we want it to be for our audience. With Shopify, I don't have to worry about technical headaches, whether it's selling directly from our website or across social media. It's all connected. The best part, it's the same checkout system we use ourselves. Trust me, it's easy, reliable, and our fans love it too. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout we use with Shopify. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/understood. In all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/understood to upgrade your selling today. That's shopify.com/understood. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think from a very surface level, you know, answer of that, it seems common. I hate to even use that word, but people with a lot of power think that they can get a lot away with a lot of things. And also that power becomes, I think, intoxicating to them. I don't know what this guy looks like. I don't know what his past was, but I'm assuming that he went from one level of being a dude, you know, to like a CEO of a company with a lot of money. And I don't know what he looked like, but his bank account probably looked good to a lot of people. Yep. And therefore he could entertain different people that he couldn't have before, maybe. I mean, that's simplifying it a lot, but that's what sounds like happens in many of these situations. And they think that they could get away with stuff that they eventually can't. So yeah, it becomes interesting. I just want to go back to the fast food stuff for one second, because I'm fascinated by it. I go to fast food chains because I have a 12-year-old daughter. And when I pick her and her friends up at school, they want to go to different places. And what I have realized is that customer service does matter. I've actually said it out loud, because when I go to Chick-fil-A, I feel like it's a completely different experience than going to a McDonald's or even a Dunkin' Donuts. Do you know what I mean? And Dunkin' Donuts is a franchise, and maybe Chick-fil-A is too. I don't know. You would know. But so I do think that's made a big difference. I don't love the food at Chick-fil-A, but I'm like, we're going to go there because it's run like a real restaurant. Like I've pulled the manager over before, not in a drive-thru, but like in a place. And I'm like, you run this place like superb. It's amazing.
Chick-fil-A is such an interesting case study, because it is actually because of how its franchise model is. And it's different than other chains. Like McDonald's is franchise, Dunkin' is franchise. Chick-fil-A is franchise, but each franchisee can only have one location. So in a lot of ways, it is more similar to a mom and pop restaurant, like a normal independent restaurant, because that franchisee, this one location, is their entire job, making sure everything is run right and making sure kind of everyone acts in the way that they're supposed to act. And like, customer service is such a big thing for Chick-fil-A, and they're able to, like, I'm sure every restaurant chain would be like, wow, I wish our employees were kind of so consistently polite. But you can't really make that happen when you're a franchisee who has dozens of locations and you're not in stores every day, and you aren't paying your employees that much. Like, people are not going to be that on it if they don't feel like someone is paying attention to them,
right,
and they aren't being paid that much. So I think that Chick-fil-A has really done an amazing job in terms of thinking about that, in terms of customer service. They regularly kind of rate at the top of all of the chains for that. And they are one of the most profitable fast food chains as a result. And I think a big reason that they're the most profitable is that customer service.
Yeah, amazing. And it's definitely noticeable. Okay. So one of the big things where you came into my life is I saw you on the screen for a couple different, you know, reasons. One of them really started with the Brandy Melville scandal, and it was a docuseries, documentary, whatever it was.
Documentary.
Yeah. And so tell us about that, because I don't know that as many people as, you know, I've brought it up to a couple of people. Some people, of course, know Brandy Melville, do not know about the scandal and haven't yet seen it on TV, which they should. It's fascinating. I mean, we all grew up kind of knowing about it, wanting to fit in their clothes. My daughter still to this day talks about it. So can you fill our listeners in on, you know, what this store is or what this company is, and how this scandal came about?
Yeah. So Brandy Melville is this teen retailer where they're selling clothes to essentially teenage girls, kind of going into your 20s, maybe your 30s, but their real market focus is teens. And their selling point is that they do one size fits all. So they only sell things in one size. And for some things, it's kind of oversized tops. For some things, it's just a pair of jeans, which only selling those in one size, only a pretty specific group of people is going to be able to wear them. Mm-hmm. I was interested in Brandy Melville back in 2021, where I was really interested because they'd grown so much. And I was curious who their CEO was, just to be like, huh, like, it's interesting this only has one size. It's interesting it's so popular. Whose idea was this? So I started trying to Google the CEO, and I just couldn't find the name anywhere, which, when you're a reporter, you know, CEOs love to talk about themselves. They love to talk about their business. It's so rare to have a CEO who is not trying to get their name out there. So I started looking through court documents to just figure out who was running this thing. And that was when I found these lawsuits accusing Brandy Melville of racial discrimination. And from there, I started talking to more and more people. And what came together was this company was a place where, in addition to only selling one size, their employees were expected to be young, thin, ideally blonde, and white. And I heard from Black and Latina employees who said, I just couldn't get hired, or I was forced to work in the stockroom while these very thin white employees were given better paying jobs where they were on the floor and in some cases kind of even elevated to models and to being able to get these perks. But the flip side of getting these perks was spending more time with this small circle of male executives where people discussed feeling like they were exploited. I talked with one young woman who said she was sexually abused by one of the male kind of people in this inner circle. And I heard from several people that they felt they had to undress to be fully nude in front of these male executives. And that was kind of part and parcel with having these extra perks and being able to be promoted. So it was a really shocking investigation where just even the most basic things that people were hired and fired based on being thin and white were, to me, shocking. They were had to send photos of themselves every single day to these male executives. So I was really shocked by all of this. And there were so many bizarre details.
So was there not one CEO? Was it a group of executives that had bought the company?
There was one CEO, Stefan Marsan, but he kind of worked in close collaboration with this group of mostly Italian male executives who were also involved in making decisions. But Stefan was kind of the CEO of a series of shell companies that ran Brandy Melville.
Mom, can you tell me a story?
Sure. Once upon a time, a mom needed a new car.
Was she brave?
She was tired, mostly. But she went to Carvana.com and found a great car at a great price. No secret treasure map required.
Did she have to fight a dragon?
Nope. She bought it 100% online. From her bed, actually.
Was it scary?
Honey, it was as unscary as car buying could be.
Did the car have a sunroof?
It did, actually.
Okay, good story.
Car buying you'll want to tell stories about. Buy your car today on
Carvana.
Delivery fees may apply.
Wow. Okay. So, and explain how you kind of got access, how you started penetrating this enough that you were able to pitch this as, you know, something that you could put on paper that then somebody bought into it and said, we got to put this on TV.
Yeah. So my original reporting, I had access to these lawsuits and all of these materials related to the lawsuits, which was incredibly helpful. I think that for people—
And that's just public. It's out there in the public
right? record, which I think that when you're a journalist, a lot of readers understandably kind of are like, oh, why should I trust you? Why should I trust these anonymous sources? But when you have actual materials that are publicly available in a lawsuit, it really removes a lot of that doubt. But in addition to that, just to kind of understand and conceptualize this, I talked to more than 30 current and former employees who said, basically, what is in these documents? It's all true. And in fact, there were even worse things happening as well. So I published all of that. And from there, there was interest in a documentary. And the documentary that ended up being made by a very talented director who has like won an Oscar before, she took this inspiration from Brandy Melville and was able to turn it into a wider reflection on fast fashion and not only how there's exploitation of Brandy Melville, but what does this look like in the wider fashion industry and how much waste there is and how it impacts women, not just in the US working for Brandy, but around the world.
After covering the scandal, do you believe that consumer awareness and social media backlash have effectively pressured Brandy Melville to change? Like, what's gone on in the company since?
That's something that I'm still trying to figure out because I had such a great response from people who had worked at Brandy Melville who said, thank you for getting the truth out. Like, this means a lot to me that this is out in the world. But on the flip side, they still seem to be doing a booming business. Like, it does not seem to have impacted their sales as far as I can see. So it's a little bit of a difficult question because I want to believe that people, when they find out a company is exploiting teenage girls, people would stop shopping there. But I haven't seen that actually happen. And I don't know if it's a lack of people knowing about this or.
I mean, I would think it's a lack of awareness. I don't know that those teenagers are the ones reading your article. I don't know that those teenagers are the ones that are seeing that documentary. Did that come out on Netflix?
HBO Max.
Yeah, HBO. That's right. So I don't know that it's seeped its way in. And sometimes that does take years, you know what I mean? And then it comes around. Were you able to access any of those male executives and talk to them?
No, I was obviously in reporting. I reached out to everyone, tried to talk to everyone, but I talked to some people who had left and who were male executives who were now kind of had turned against the company, but no current executives were willing to speak with me.
I mean, there's a growing trend of people that are whistleblowers or people that want to come out and speak in every industry. I mean, from fast food to tech to retail, whatever the scandal might be. Did you find that it was really hard to get people to want to talk because they were nervous of the backlash, especially in something like this where nothing seems to be affected in the company? So why talk? You know, you can't, if they can't bring them down, you can't elevate your position. What's the reasoning that they're going to do it?
It was incredibly difficult to get people to talk. And there's so much fear that is still built in to people where they were really scared about what would happen to them. And for a lot of them, they still are friends with people who have worked there or continue to work there. It's a real community mindset. So I think that for people, that was a little bit of a double-edged sword. Some people were afraid of speaking up if it would hurt people who were still working there. But I think that for a lot of people who spoke with me, while they hoped that there would be bigger changes and it would impact the company's bottom line, it also felt like they were able to speak to kind of tell other women, this wasn't just you, like I experienced this as well. And that was a way to create change and create community and kind of make something of this traumatic experience for them.
Yeah. I don't follow the company that well. Do they still have brick and mortar stores or has it moved to just online?
They still have brick and mortar stores and they're expanding into restaurants now. I haven't reported too much on this, but they've been doing more in the restaurant space and they're continuing international expansion.
Interesting. You mean to put a restaurant like in addition where the retail space is?
They kind of are opening these little cafes that are not called Brandy Melville, but they've started opening restaurants under different names that are next to or around. I need to return to my reporting on this. If anyone. Yeah.
I'm curious if these girls
any
are
inside
all these-
scoop, reach out to me because they're, I'm very curious about what the business plan is with this. It's very interesting.
And it'll be interesting to see if it's all these skinny white.
Exactly.
Young women, being the hosts.
Yes.
Okay. So now let's get to another one that you did a lot of coverage on. You covered the Nickelodeon scandal. For people that are not aware of this, can you give us a brief synopsis of what that was?
Yes. So I think that for years there have been rumors and online discussions on Nickelodeon and Nickelodeon under Dan Schneider. And that was something that I think there's been so much talk about online where people felt like certain things were established fact and some were and some were just rumors. So in 2022, I decided to try and do this deep dive and actually talk to people and say, what happened when you were at Nickelodeon? What did you see? Do you feel like the public has an accurate viewpoint on this?
So wait, up until that moment, you had just heard rumblings about it. Had it been in the media at that point yet?
There was.
He missed the boat with the Me Too thing. Like he skated through.
It was something where there wasn't anything that came out with Me Too. I had heard I was reporting, there was a lot of rumblings at Nickelodeon during Me Too, like, is there going to be a Me Too for children's entertainment? Will it impact us? And there wasn't really a big reckoning at that moment for children's entertainment. There was an article about Dan Schneider in the New York Times in 2021 that kind of delved into this, but also people who I had heard spoke with the New York Times for the article felt the resulting piece was a little bit gave Dan Schneider credit on things that they don't think that he deserved credit on. Some people felt like the piece was a little bit too positive to Dan Schneider. So when I wrote my article in 2022, it kind of dug deeper into what the culture was on the set of this specific era of Nickelodeon shows. And I was focused pretty solidly on Dan Schneider and his shows. And some of the issues that emerged was people felt like they couldn't really ever push back against what he wanted. And he had total control over these kids' careers. And as a result, people felt like there were decisions that were maybe not appropriate for a kids' TV show, like scenes that had risque humor or outfits that were somewhat a little bit too mature or a little bit too, showed a little bit too much skin. Yeah. So I published that and there were parts of the story that I just either didn't feel directly related to Dan Schneider or that I couldn't quite nail down. So shortly after publishing, the directors who would become the directors of Quiet on Set reached out and said, do you think there's more to this story? And I was like, yes, definitely. I think there's so much more here. And what we worked on from there ended up becoming a docuseries called Quiet on Set, The Dark Side of Kids TV, that delved into these wider issues of child exploitation at the time. And one of the biggest—
Did you help with the research on that as well? Because that seems like it took it a step further.
It took things a step further, and I helped with the research and some of the access, but I have to say the directors also did an incredible job, and the whole team there did a great job really doggedly reporting and kind of trying to take things wider than my original investigation had.
What is that like, working on a piece and then seeing how big it gets? And that did make a huge impact. Where people were talking about it, people were floored. I mean, it was like front page news for a really long time.
It was really wild to kind of be working on something for so long. It can feel like it's very interior and you don't know what the reaction is going to be like. Mm-hmm. To have such a massive, massive immediate reaction was really gratifying in a way where you see how much people care about this and how much people want to see change in this area. And that is really helpful, where you can feel like you're working on something and you don't know if it's going to actually make a change or if people will care about this. And this was something that it felt like people were very, very kind of invested in trying to find solutions.
In terms of Nickelodeon, what do you think were the most significant factors that allowed this concerning behavior to persist behind the scenes for so long without public scrutiny? But I mean, it seems to happen all the time until it comes out. And when you hear these stories, it's like, oh, it's been happening for 10 years, for 20 years. The abuse was so bad. It wasn't just with one person. It was with 50 people. Like, how do they keep it under wraps for so long?
I think one of the bigger things is the culture that existed, and to some degree, I think continues to exist in show business, where there's this idea that for child actors, they aren't really children, that they think of themselves as adults because they're the ones who are supporting their family. And that puts them in situations where it becomes really difficult for them to say no to something or to escape a situation that might be uncomfortable because they have the pressure of being the breadwinner for their family on their shoulders. So that allows things to escalate. It also puts these kids in a situation where they can think, I'm an adult. Like, I can be having these adult relationships. Like, it's normal for me to be friends with someone who is 30 years older than me. It's normal for me to be spending time one-on-one with an adult who kind of might end up trying to approach me sexually. And I think that it's hard because in some ways, what I heard from child actors who said, these relationships were really meaningful to me. They were mentorships. I still have close, positive relationships with older people who took an interest in me that was not sexual at all. But I think that the culture that treats these kids as adults and puts them in a position where everyone is treating them as if they are expected to be totally mature in this way really hurts child actors in a myriad of different ways.
Right. Okay, so this is a journalist question. What were some of the challenges you faced when covering the Nickelodeon scandal, I guess, and others? Like, how did you approach gathering and verifying sensitive information, especially when you're talking about something that has to do with sex?
Yeah, I think that something that was difficult for this was, unlike the Brandy Melville story, for example, in that story, we had some concrete lawsuits with very concrete examples of discrimination.
And the work seems like it had been done for you at the beginning there.
It was something where you were building, you're kind of taking this concrete lawsuit and then building off of it with more stories and more context. In this one, there was a lawsuit, but it was filed by a John Doe. So we knew that there was an instance of more than one, but the one we focused in on was this child actor who was sexually abused by his acting coach, Brian Peck. But we didn't have the name of the child. And we had heard rumors that it might be Drake Bell. And in that situation, you are kind of at a crossroads where you have heard that it might be this person. This is an incredibly famous child actor. Where do you go from there? we would never expose a victim without their consent. We would never use Drake's name publicly if he didn't want to be involved. But this is something that we kind of were working through, where we knew it would make the piece very powerful to have someone like Drake speaking, someone that so many people recognize from their childhood, someone that they relate to Drake. They kind of feel like they grew up with him. Him speaking about this would feel very immediate for a lot of people. And even if he wasn't famous, like, this story is so horrific in and of itself, of someone being groomed and abused because of a culture that treated children like adults. Mm-hmm. So we knew that having Drake would be very important, but we didn't know if Drake would want to participate. So he eventually did decide to participate, and kind of building that relationship and building that trust. I have to say the directors were incredible in doing that. But that was a long process, and something that for me, up until pretty late in the game, I was like, I don't know if he'll want to be involved in this. Like, this is really, really hard to talk about publicly, not even being a public figure, even someone who is a completely private individual, someone who has never been famous, asking anyone to go on camera and talk about the worst thing or one of the worst things that has ever happened to them. That is a really difficult request to make.
Oh, 100%. And listen, as someone, I did a HBO Max docuseries with Alex Gibney, and they are very, very good at, I mean, listen, I don't think it's someone who they want you to narrate what happened. Otherwise, they're going to tell the story anyway. So I think for me, it was kind of like, I saw the credibility of who was making the story. And ultimately, I ended up trusting them. I spent so much time with them, and I knew that they were going to tell the story in a way that they would do their best to shed light on what happened, but it would come best from me. So ultimately, that's why I chose to do it. And people, like, also in those situations, like, you're not doing it. There was no money exchange. Like, you are at that point where you want to tell your story because you need to, for your own freedom, you know, for your own, like, to be able to sleep at night better. So I can't speak for him. I can speak for me. I was in, circumstances were different, but just in working with those guys at HBO, and they're very, very good. And they lived up to everything they said they would. I trusted them, and they were great with everything they did. So I get that. I wanted to ask, so now after the fact, we asked about Brandy Melville. Did you see any changes to Nickelodeon? Like, what has happened with that company since?
I think this has been something where we have been able to see a lot more movement for change. We've been in contact with kind of the unions, and with even kind of governments, on talking about, like, what laws need to be passed. What do unions need to be pushing for here? Like, this is something that I do think for Nickelodeon specifically, they had made some of the changes since this happened that would hopefully prevent child predators from working at somewhere like Nickelodeon. Mm-hmm. But I think that something that I'm really revved up about and care a lot about is making sure this doesn't happen again, not just at Nickelodeon, but in all forms of children entertainment. So now you have things like child influencers, where that is something where it is so much more nebulous and so much more uncertain. And, like, you don't have a big network that can make rules. So how do we turn to the government or to different organizations and continue thinking about what changes can be made, either in terms of laws or just, okay, how do we give people basic advice on how to do this to avoid putting kids in situations? Like, how do we educate children on what grooming looks like? And I think that that's something that just talking about it can create a really positive change in a direction that can protect kids.
Yeah. And I think it's such a fine line because, there are kids, like you're talking about, these influencers who do not look like kids. I mean, teenagers do not look like teenagers from when I was a teenager. Okay. Sometimes you look at someone who's 14, 15, 16, and you think that they're in their 20s, early 30s, they're dressing sexy because this is what sells. And this is, and they're okay with that too. But that doesn't mean that they're adult yet in their thinking. So I think there's a lot of lines that get blurred. I think also, as the person that's coming up as the creator, the entertainer, sometimes they think that it's not about just like, oh, I need to, give away sexual favors to get this, but it's more like, I want to be an adult. People are really racing to be an adult now, to be famous, to be, and so they think that goes along with it. And I think some of it is about them stepping into that adulthood way before they should. And they don't even see it as bad. So
it's something that I think that was the mindset for a lot of these child actors. And it's almost like that mindset has gone from being something that kids have in Hollywood to that kids have all over the United States because of social media. So it's something where there have to be wider things versus just Disney or Nickelodeon making some changes.
Oh, yeah, for sure. So I wanted to ask you about social media now that we're talking about it. It's played a huge role in popularizing, making things popular, from food to clothing, everything like that, certain trends. And when I was younger, it was like you saw a commercial for something and that's what made it cool. You know, like you would drink Coke, you would drink, you know, whatever it was, you would chew Bubblicious. I don't know. You would get the Cabbage Patch Kid because that's what everyone was buying. And if you didn't get it, you were the loser, you know? Now it's totally different and everything is made popular on social media. And it takes sometimes a influencer to make that popular. So I want to ask you, you know, what are the trends that you're seeing within that? Like, do you still think that influencers make a big deal and create these trends? Do you think that's going away? Do you think it's dangerous? Do you think it's good for brands? Like, what are your thoughts on it as somebody who covers this?
Totally. I think that it is so huge right now. And I think that how influencers and where influencers are really gaining this dominance is super interesting. I mean, looking at Brandy Melville, that was peak Tumblr and Instagram. And that's why the brand really took off, is because it was able to find the way inside of these social media algorithms. I think because they relied so much on teenage girls that it took off in a way that felt super organic. I'm not sure what is going to come next here. I think that TikTok right now is, to me, the biggest driving force on social media in terms of setting trends, kind of reaching this massive audience. Probably TikTok and Instagram are setting those, but I'm not sure what comes next. I think that it's, well, I can actually speak about the business school take on this. I was in class recently where we were discussing social media and we voted like how many of you would be happier if Instagram didn't exist. And it was pretty much a 50-50 split. Like Instagram. I was fine with Instagram existing. But for the half of the class who said they'd rather have Instagram not exist, the question was, how many of you have Instagram? And the majority still have Instagram, even though they wish it didn't exist as a whole.
Did they wish it didn't exist because they couldn't figure it out? Or
no, like, it was just they wish it didn't exist because it made them feel bad. It made them, it sucked up a lot of time. It made them feel badly about themselves. I mean, I understand those critiques, but I like Instagram because I'm nosy and it's helpful for reporting. But these people said basically the reason why they're still on it, even though they don't enjoy how it makes them feel or how much time it takes up, is this fear of missing out. And I think that that's kind of become the most dominant idea around social media now, is like this feeling that if I'm not there, everyone is like hanging out without me. And I think back when I was in high school, that was something that was pretty literal, where it was like, oh, people are in person hanging out without me. But now I think that it becomes very digital, where there's you can see when people are physically hanging out without you online, but also you feel like you have to be totally tapped in at all times, or you could miss out on something. So I think that that's one of the things of social media that is interesting to kind of grapple with. And I don't know the easy solution there.
And not only that, it's like, what are you missing out on by not buying it? So at least a couple times a week, I will get a package and my daughter will run past me and grab it. And I'll be like, what is that? And she's like, oh, it's from TikTok shop or whatever. Or this, oh, mom, it's a trend on TikTok. Everybody's doing it, which like makes it okay that all of a sudden my money's gone because she spent it all on some crazy thing that breaks in 2 seconds and they have to make a TikTok about it. It's like insane, but it is what they all do and follow. And, you know, for me as a parent, I'm like, oh, okay, she's finding things to do. She's an only kid. It makes her feel like she's part of a community, I guess. And all of her friends are doing it. And they're all on FaceTime getting excited about it and opening it, you know?
And it's something where it's like, that's not that different in some ways than us growing up. Like there'd always be like some fad where it's like, oh, I need a Beanie Baby. I need this. But I think it just feels so much more overwhelming now because it's like, oh, who are you hanging out with, but also like, are you up on what to buy? Are you like doing this as quickly as possible? And it feels like the trends go so quickly. I mean, some of this, I feel like just makes me sound old, but I do think that there's a level of anxiety that's built in on social media around belonging that wasn't quite all encompassing in prior decades. And I think that that can be pretty harmful.
Yeah, I do agree with that. Okay. As a journalist covering the, I was going to frame this as the food industry, but I guess in any industry, what do you think has been the most surprising or underreported story that you've ever come across? And why do you think it hasn't got the attention it deserved?
Oh, that is such a good question. Let me think. A story, this is something I want to write more about that I touched on a little bit earlier. I want to write more about child influencers and the impact of that and the long-term impact of that. So if anyone watching this has thoughts, please reach out, because I think that that is something that it's been reported on, but there's going to be more and more stories on what growing up as a child influencer or just growing up in general on social media does to someone. Yeah. And I think it's not underreported because of people ignoring it. It's underreported just because all of these things are so new. So,
and I have a question. What do they do with their lives after? I mean, once if they've started young and then they get into their 20s, unless they elevate that to something else, like how do you turn that into a real job later in life? And not only that, I'm wondering if some of these people's whole livelihoods are based on complete fake numbers. You know, you can buy followers, you can buy all sorts of things. Then you get random people behind you that build you up. But does that house of cards fall at some point? And then you have absolutely no skills later on in life. And it's not even too deep into life. You're in your late 20s. And then it's like, you really lived a fake life. So that's my question for when you're recording it.
I mean, we've seen so much with how media publications kind of like pivot because they're like, oh, we're getting all these views this way, or like, oh, we're getting all this traffic from this social media. And then something changes and then that just falls apart. And like, that's hard when it's a media publication. It often leads to layoffs. But when it's one person's entire livelihood, like, I don't know what you do from there. And I think that that is something that is going to continue to play out for more and more people as being an influencer is seen as a career that people are trying to
win. And also what happens when they've lived a life like Alex Earle, for example, or you know, something like that, and then they say something to get canceled. Mm-hmm. Well, what skills do they have to translate this into anything else as well? And were they educated enough not to say the things they said, or did they say them because they're an asshole? You know, like, I don't know what kind of credentials they had to do their get readies with me and put on cute clothes that people send them for free. I mean, how does that make you a smart person? You're saying dumb things probably because you haven't been educated and lived a life filled with experiences to know what to say and not to say. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
So that's another question I have.
It is very similar to like the 90s child stars, I think, where it's these people would kind of be in their mid-20s and it'd be harder to get roles because the casting directors are like, oh, like you're too known for being a former child star. Like it's not a good fit. But then they're like, I haven't gone to college. I made money, but not that much money when you're living off of it every day. And I don't have a marketable skill now. So like, what do I do? Where do I go from here? And I think, I think that a lot of influencers are going to face the same questions.
Yeah. And by the way, that's in any industry. I speak to athletes all the time who were stars in their field and then they retire or they're sidelined because of an injury and they literally don't know what to do with their lives. And they all become alcoholics or whatever, because they really don't know what to do. It's actually a terrible thing. And it shows you how important education is when you're a kid. I mean, you know, just having a foundation of something so you can have other things going on. And that's why people pivot into, I don't know, you see real estate agents who were reality stars or A-list actors, you know, driving Uber cars at some point because they don't know how to pivot and it's all gone sideways for them because they've been left in the dust in whatever way, shape or form. Okay. And then my last question for you, I want to know, and again, I know you're on hiatus right now from working, but there's so many stories in the news right now. You must be freaking out that you're like not able to be writing all the time and pitching stories. What are the current things that you're following? Oh, and by the way, before you answer that, you're in New York right now. What do you think, or what does everybody at Columbia think about Eric Adams being indicted?
My phone has been lighting up for this entire call and I have not looked at my text. So I will see. I mean, the Eric Adams indictment is truly like, that is a fascinating story. And I'm sure there's going to be fascinating reporting coming out here because we just have all the elements of a true high drama. I mean, you've got the...
You have him already coming out and saying that he's innocent and that it was all fabricated, and it's going
to be interesting. It's going to be an interesting time. So, I mean, I'm very excited to be reading all about that story, and I'm a little bit sad that I can't be reporting on it myself.
And it'll be interesting to see if somebody has to step in, if Cuomo is going to come back, the beloved Cuomo who everybody canceled, and now will he be mayor again? I mean, will he be mayor?
It'll be out of control, I think. I'm really curious. And I mean, I hope, and this is always my hope in general, where I'm like, I hope that this is an opportunity to have new, fresh voices with really innovative new ideas emerge. Yeah. We'll see if that ever happens, but who can say? And I think that things that I'm thinking about for stories, I mean, one of the stories I wrote at BI that was a little bit more low-key or niche was about residential cruise companies, basically people moving to live on cruise ships for the rest of their lives. It's a space that's filled with a lot of kind of scammers, and it's just also incredibly impossible to make happen because making a cruise ship something people can live on permanently is very, very hard. I'm looking into that more. I think that there's some interesting stories there. I'm interested in...
I know someone who is selling that. So we'll have to talk because when he said that to me, I was like, that is such a dumb idea. I don't get that.
There's a huge market for it, but it's incredibly hard to make work. I think that there's a lot of interesting things happening in cruise industry right now that I'm curious about. And then I also, this is something super general, but I've been wanting to write more about family businesses. That's something that being in business school has made me think a lot about, and kind of the inherent difficulties of working with your family. So I'm kind of poking around on some family business stories as well.
You should look into, and he's a friend of mine, I can set you up with him, but Alan Rosen, he owns Junior's Cheesecake.
And it was
family owned. And I think he had to buy out his brother. There was all sorts of infighting, and he now owns it. He was thinking of running for mayor of New York recently. Yeah. Good guy, but like he has a lot of stories about running it with his family. So, but yeah, I think that's fascinating. And there are obviously bigger stories and there are smaller stories, but the stuff that goes on between a family is definitely, there's a lot of drama to it.
Yes. It's hard working with family on like the smallest of ideas. So the biggest ideas I feel like can be so weighty. Well, it was so lovely talking with you.
I wish you good luck at Columbia. I can't wait to see the next story that you come out with, and we will have you on again next time you publish something big and get to the bottom of it. Cause I'd love to hear about it. I wish you the best of luck. Tell people where they can find you and look up some of your stories if they want to.
Yes, I'm on Twitter at Kate_H_Taylor. You can look at my website, katehtaylor.com. And those are probably the best ways to find me. But it was great talking with you about all of this.
Yes, I appreciate you, and we will be in touch.
Thank you so much for listening to Misunderstood. I'm your host, Rachel Yucatel. Please be sure to subscribe to the show and give us a 5-star rating and review. You can support the show by joining our Patreon at patreon.com/misunderstood with Rachel Yucatel. Do you have ideas for the show or want to reach out? Email us at info@misunderstoodpodcast@gmail.com. That's spelled MISS understood. Thank you so much, and I'll see you next time.